This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Yesterday, Russian President Vladimir Putin introduced a plan that would drastically change the face of Russian politics. For days, he'd been hinting at a major policy shift following a series of terrorist attacks that culminated in the massacre at a school in southern Russia that took more than 300 lives. Last week, President Putin said Russia had been too weak in response to terrorism. Yesterday, he proposed steps that he said would unite the country and make it stronger. Regional governors, now elected by popular vote, would be instead nominated by the president and confirmed by local legislatures. The lower house of parliament, the Duma, would be entirely elected from party lists. Half are now elected in districts, like members of Congress. While many in Russia endorsed President Putin's ideas, critics described it as a power grab that had nothing to do with terrorism and a major step backwards for democracy. Later this hour, Hurricane Ivan takes aim at the Gulf Coast. We'll catch up with preparations. But first, President Putin's plan for a more centralized Russia. We'll find out more about what the plans are, the Bush administration's reaction, and what this could mean for democracy in Russia. If you have questions, our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And the email address is totn@npr.org. Scott Peterson joins us now. He's a reporter for the Christian Science Monitor. He's with us by phone from Moscow. Good of you to stay up and be with us.
No problem. Thanks.
So tell us a little bit more about President Putin's plan. First of all, the regional governors.
Well, they are there are 89 regional governorships in Russia. Of course, this is a country that spans 11 time zones, so it truly is vast. And one of the things, this is one of the measures that actually has been in the works for a long time, well before this latest spate of terrorist attacks. In fact, some have been discussing it for up to a year. The reason for that is because the regional governors have created, in some cases, their own fiefdoms. They have really done things that have undermined the central power's authority here in Moscow and at the Kremlin. Putin saw this. Putin wanted to bring those governors under control. And I think that he simply decided that doing this in the aftermath of these attacks was the best and most painless way to do it.
Now, what about the members of the Duma?
Well, this is where we start getting into issues of real democracy in Russia or not, and especially with the case of the Duma, where the proposal from the president is to ensure that only candidates that are from lists that are nationwide lists of very, very large parties. And, of course, he's talking about the ruling party, which already controls two-thirds of the state Duma. There are just a handful, two or three other parties that even made it across the threshold. But half the candidates that are in, half of the people that are in the Duma already at the moment are really from kind of single-mandate contests. These are people who are independent candidates. They're not really entirely under the control of the Kremlin, and basically they're a thorn in the side because among them are some of the most noisy opponents of the Kremlin. So fragile as Russia's democracy was in the lead-up to these decisions, these decisions now certainly show and indicate that the Kremlin is taking all the reins of power into its hands.
Well, let me just clarify. So half the seats in the Duma now are elected the way we elect members of Congress. It's Smith versus Jones versus Aksemyov running against each other to represent a certain district. Is that right?
That's precisely right. And they are not necessarily attached to any of the larger national parties, which means that they are not then controlled by those national parties.
So they could be independent.
In many cases, they are independent. Oftentimes, they're controllable, but also among them are some of the strongest opponents. I mean, weak as that opposition is these days, but they are among the strongest opponents to the Kremlin.
And these party lists, again, for those, a voter would not choose Smith, Jones, or Aksemyov. They would choose the Motherland Party or United Russia. And then if they get over 5% of the total vote, then they get proportionally a number of delegates.
That's right. Although, a lot of the opposition candidates, and we saw this in the elections in December, a lot of the opposition candidates did not make that 5% threshold. I mean, it's just done enough because it's not a question of, in Russia, when we're talking about democracy here, it's not just a question of, you know, does the vote of the people count? I mean, certainly people are voting and their votes are counted, but the way that the electorate is shaped in the run-up to elections is kind of a pre-engineering of the way these elections are handled here, means that really the outcome on election day is not at all in doubt, because those candidates that are favored by the Kremlin, favored by the ruling party, have all the assets of the state at their disposal, while really we're seeing often smear campaigns and other things directed at at opponents. So really, it is tough for those people these days to get into the Duma anyway. Never mind these new restrictions.
Now, some say that President Putin's plan is unconstitutional and that you'd have to change the Constitution, which isn't so easy. He says the Duma can vote on this and just go ahead.
Well, that's exactly what he says, and these days he can make that kind of decision. And normally, such a change would require a constitutional amendment, and that really is not beyond the current institutions of power in Russia. I mean, already the ruling party does control 2/3 of the seats, which is enough to initiate a constitutional debate. Certainly, people would be asking themselves serious questions, and I think that's one of the reasons why President Putin has really kind of minimized the obstacle size, if you will, of trying to vote on this, basically saying that this is not an issue that is going to require a constitutional change. And I don't think he wants to put it up for a vote, but certainly if he wants to, he already has enough power in his hands to pull that off.
So no doubt that if he needs legislation, he could get it passed. Is there an equivalent to the Supreme Court, which could then rule on this?
Well, it wouldn't be one that would make a difference. I mean, basically, the Kremlin has been, during the last 4 years of Putin's rule, has been basically gathering up all the different elements. I mean, very slowly but very surely, they've called it different names. At one point, when changes were made a few years ago, it was called strengthening the power vertical, which meant that what Putin had done was made decisions and basically created a new set of regional governorships and basically federal presidents that were meant to from the regions be connected directly to him, to answer directly to him, and they were supposed to be a new layer of bureaucracy that were going to be placed on and help control some of these regional governors. In other cases, the Kremlin likes to call this managed democracy. It's difficult to describe what that means, except what it appears in practice has been to basically reinstall order in a very serious way from the center, from the Kremlin. And basically what they're trying to do, and what President Putin is trying to do, is to kind of get rid of all the variables that existed during the crazy 1990s in Russia, where really he feels, and I think a lot of Russians also to a degree feel, that democracy, quote-unquote, got out of hand, just as the economy did, just as, you know, everything kind of fell apart after the collapse of the Soviet Union.
But he's tied these changes to make the country stronger to respond to terrorism. Has he explained how one thing leads to the other?
Well, he's not explained that at all, in fact. I think what he's trying to do at the moment is really look like action is underway to help reassure Russians. Most analysts that I have spoken to who knew that these kind of changes were afoot were really expecting them to be announced in October and November. So that was one thing. So this has all been pushed forward because of these terrorist attacks. It allows the president to look like he's doing something, even though obviously this is a separate political thing. No one has explained yet at all how these kind of political changes to the political system are actually going to somehow protect Russia from the kind of attacks that we've seen just in the last 3 weeks. We've had two passenger jets that have been downed by explosives. We've had a suicide bomb in Moscow, and then we've also had this incredible hostage siege down in Beslan, which ended up killing 330 people, or about that many, and which, certainly in recent history, seems to have been the second most lethal terrorist act after the September 11 attacks in the U.S.
And finally, what's been reaction to Putin's plan in political circles throughout Russia, the governors, members of the Duma, and the opposition?
Well, most people know that there's very, very little that they can do. So while there has been some opposition, it has been relatively muted. The usual suspects, if you will, in terms of those who are you know, who are critics of the Kremlin, of course, accuse the Kremlin of using the terrorist tragedies of recent weeks and using that as basically a lever to grab more, you know, make a blatant power grab, basically. But for most people and those who are, you know, taking part in the political game here, I mean, they're also fully aware that that basically there's very little that they can do. That democracy has been something, as I mean, democracy as we would define it in the West has been kind of withering in Russia. And let's keep in mind, too, that this is not the kind of thing that Russians are going to be congenitally against either. Putin's popularity ratings remain in the high 70s or low 80s, which are really miracle levels for any Western politician to achieve. So he's got that kind of support, and a lot of Russians will tell you that you know, they're all for cracking down. They will often say that you know, they don't mind if they have to give up some of these, you know, this, you know, so-called democracy or some aspects of it, if that's going to make us safer. You know, the fact that no one's explained how these kind of political changes are going to make them safer seems beside the point in a country where really most people's ideas and thoughts about this are formed by what they see on television, and all of those channels are controlled by the state.
Scott Peterson, thanks very much. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Scott Peterson, a reporter for the Christian Science Monitor, joined us on the phone from Moscow. If you have questions, by the way, about what's happening in Russia, its relation to the war on terrorism, how the United States should respond, call us, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. Joining us now is Thomas Remington, chair of the Political Science Department at Emory University, the author of Politics in Russia. He's with us from the university's Media Relations Center in Atlanta, Georgia. Good to have you on the program.
Thank you.
President Putin is, as we noted, pitching this as a response to make the country stronger, to respond to terrorism. How are the political reforms and terrorism related, if at all?
It's not likely that reforming the electoral structure for the Duma is going to be a very effective measure against terrorism. And I also doubt that by appointing governors, he's going to be able to combat terrorism more effectively. I think these are reforms which he's had in mind for a long time, that they've been proposed before the terrorist attacks. And this has given him an opportunity to put into motion some plans that had been developing beforehand.
Now, some have said that those regional governors elected regionally have been, examples of regional pride, one of the things that have kept obstreperous regions still within the Russian Federation, places like the North Caucasus. How are those places going to respond to having their governors appointed by Moscow?
I think President Putin, if this reform goes into effect, as I'm sure it will take into account the local balance of power in each republic and each region and choose people who are very good at mediating between the demands of the local population and his own political program and imperatives.
So is this going to help or hurt?
The real test of whether these reforms are going to be effective is not so much whether democracy is reformed or improved or made more efficient. It's whether he can get the bureaucracy to be more effective. I think one of the great problems with the whole Chechen crisis that has indirectly led to this awful Beslan horror is that both the administrative structures and the police structures in Chechnya have been deeply inefficient and deeply corrupt. And so I think ultimately what Putin is trying to do is to bring some discipline and accountability into his own state bureaucracy. And to do that, he's trying to undermine the few weak checks and balances that have existed in the political sphere.
So he can have untrammeled power.
That's his instinct. You know, as we know, he himself comes out of the KGB, and this is his instinct for how to centralize power.
We're talking with Thomas Remington about Vladimir Putin, the president of Russia, and his proposed political reforms. If you'd like to join us, 800-989-8255. Email is totn@npr.org. We're back after a break. Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about Russia, a new plan from President Vladimir Putin to consolidate power. Critics call it a power grab and a step backwards for democracy. If you've lived or work in Russia, are you surprised to see the Russian Federation moving in this direction? You're invited to join our conversation. 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. In an interview with the news service Reuters, Secretary of State Colin Powell said today, quote, "In effect, this is pulling back on some of the democratic reforms as seen by the international community that have occurred in the past. We understand," the Secretary of State said, "the need to fight against terrorism, but in an attempt to go after terrorists, I think one has to strike a proper balance to make sure you don't move in a direction that takes you away from the democratic reforms or the democratic process." Secretary Powell said that Washington would raise this issue with Moscow in the days ahead. What do you think the United States should say to President Putin at that meeting? 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our guest is Thomas Remington, Chair of Political Science Department at Emory University and the author of Politics in Russia. Let's get a caller on the line, and this is Paul, who's with us from Panama City Beach in Florida, where, Paul, I assume you're getting ready for the hurricane there.
Actually, I'm in the process of evacuating right now.
Uh-huh. Well, good. Well, I'm glad you've taken time out to make a call. There's still time. Go ahead with your question.
My question / comment is, listening to the average Russian over the past number of years lament for the security of the old Soviet days, I'm wondering if the average Russian looks at these changes being put in place by President Putin as a bit of the old security blanket coming back. And I'm just curious what the, realizing they may not be able to do anything about it as an average citizen, are they looking at it with a little bit of happiness, maybe?
Tom Remington?
Well, there is a lot of nostalgia for the life of the Soviet Union, which had, as we know, a great deal of security for people socially and economically. Where people put up with an awful lot of restriction on their personal freedom, but in return, the state assured them certain guarantees, both for their present and their old age. It was also a state, as we know, where there was prevalent police presence, and people did not have to fear terrorist attacks of this kind. So yes, there's a great deal of, I think, nostalgia for the old order. At the same time, all of the public opinion polls show that Russians really do prize democratic freedoms. One of the most interesting findings to come out of our studies of Russian public opinion is that many people see Putin as bringing democracy. They associate him with a more open economic policy, more trade, more investment. They certainly see him developing the economy. Unemployment has gone down. Wages and pensions are getting paid. And he is regarded as progressive in many ways. So people, on the one hand, certainly want security, especially after these horrors of the terrorist attacks of the last couple of weeks, but they're not willing to sacrifice all of the opportunities that the changes since the end of communism have opened up.
Paul, thanks very much, and please be safe, will you?
Thank you very much.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Let's talk now with Sam. Sam's calling from Oklahoma City.
Yes, how are you?
Very well, thanks.
Well, I think the Russian problems, the Chechen problems, are more geopolitical and socio-economical problems. Those problems are really, really not a terrorist problems. In the name of the terrorism, in the name of the Islam, terrorists commit a crime. In the name of the terrorism, we commit also the crime, in a sense, against the people which are innocent. You know, I mean, I don't know how we can justify that. The freedom struggle of the Chechen people equate with the terrorism. I mean, of course, these means are all wrong. You know, I mean, don't get me wrong. I mean, I'm just saying I don't support any of those. But if you look at the Grozny, if our media does the right job, there is not a standing building in Grozny.
Grozny, the capital of Chechnya.
Yeah, yeah, I mean, come on. Let's put a problem where it belongs. You know, why don't have a Russia loose federation with an autonomous body or something where these people, if they want a freedom, they can have their what they want?
Well, Thomas Remington, obviously there has been a lot of abuse on both sides in Chechnya, according to everybody who's...
They were given the freedom anyway once. Yep. Have been taken back again.
Okay, Sam. Thanks. Hold on. Go ahead, Thomas Remington.
There's no question about the fact that the Russian central government has terribly mishandled the entire Chechen situation. This goes back to 1991, when the Soviet Union was falling apart and there was a great deal of uncertainty among everyone as to what would the eventual shape of the country be. And there was a leader in Chechnya, General Dudayev. He was Chechen, but he had come up through the Soviet military, who, with a group of supporters, declared independence of Russia. Now, he didn't have the legal right to do that, and Russia never recognized the act of independence. Chechnya was and is a republic within Russia. It was not one of the 15 Soviet republics. It was not like Georgia or Lithuania. It was an autonomous republic within Russia. Well, when Dudayev declared independence, Yeltsin at first tried to suppress it, but did not use force immediately. 1994, Yeltsin introduced federal ground troops into Chechnya and began this brutal military effort to pacify Chechnya, resulting in the terrible bombing of Grozny, as our caller mentioned. And there's no question but that the brutality of Russian tactics contributed to the chaos and disorder in Chechnya that contributed in turn to the rise of terrorism. Then you add to that this religious element, where a wing of the Chechen independence movement has embraced radical Wahhabite fundamentalist extremism and has turned to terrorism. And they are getting support from international terrorist organizations. How much is in dispute? So yes, there's plenty of blame to go around on both sides. And right now, I think the Russian leadership would like some new relationship with Chechnya, where the Chechens would be able to govern themselves with a lot of autonomy, short of full independence. But the problem is there's no one in Chechnya now strong enough who's a moderate who could restore order.
Joining us now on the phone from Moscow is Andrew Jack, Moscow bureau chief for the Financial Times, author of a new book titled Inside Putin's Russia. Thanks very much for being up to speak with us tonight.
Pleasure.
President Putin himself is a bit of a mysterious figure, former KGB official, as we've heard, judo champion, who's pursued an interesting path through Russia, something he calls managed democracy. What does that mean?
Yes, I mean, managed democracy is the term really that some of his political opponents have used. It means essentially that a lot of the institutions that we might understand in the West of democracy are in place. You know, a parliament, an upper house to examine legislation that's been voted through, elected governors, although that now seems to be changing. But on the other hand, the actual substance of those institutions is increasingly one where the Kremlin itself and Mr. Putin personally has a strong say in the selection of the individuals that are put into those institutions and the way in which they actually develop policy and legislation and implement it.
Now, yesterday's proposal is not the first time that Putin has moved to consolidate power in Russia, nor has he restricted himself strictly to political reform. He gathered control over much of the media as well.
Yeah, I think if we look at the balance sheet, if you like, of the first 4 years of Putin's term, however much it might have been his desire at the start, the outcomes look quite disappointing from a Western perspective. There's no doubt that, in particular, the two fully state-owned national television channels and the one which is partly under state control, NTV, have all become much more pro-Kremlin in their views, much less, shall we say, independent in their editorial judgments and what they choose to report upon. So that's in terms of the media. And we've also seen some curtailment, incidentally, of critical reporting, partly through Kremlin pressure and partly through self-censorship in the print media as well and radio stations. But then we've also got the democratic institutions. And what we've heard this week is really a continuation of efforts to effectively neuter some of that grassroots democracy that was beginning very tentatively to emerge during the 1990s with locally elected and locally accountable politicians in favor, again, of a system which gives the form of modern democracy, but actually in terms of substance is a very, very different form of structure.
And in that context, should we look at the current prosecution of Mr. Khodorkovsky, the former head of Yukos, the giant oil company, should we look at those efforts as a way of bringing down possible political rivals?
I think there's no doubt here, not only by opponents, but also if you talk discreetly to government officials and those in the Kremlin, that the attacks by the authorities against UCOS are politically motivated. And in many ways, Mr. Putin associates the democratic signs of the 1990s with chaos, anarchy, and corruption. And in that, his opinion is shared by many, many ordinary Russians. So I think in many ways his analysis of the threat to the system that he is trying to build was that Khodorkovsky and, and his company UCOS and other philanthropic activities that Khodorkovsky was involved in, as well as direct funding to Russian politicians, was an attempt to destabilize Putin and the pro-Putin parties within the parliament in the build-up to elections last year. And in many ways, one could argue, perhaps his analysis was right within his own terms. The problem was that the techniques that have been used, particularly against UCOS, of arbitrary justice, are actually further undermining the creation of rule of law and the establishment of institutions as opposed to individuals who are loyal essentially to Mr. Putin. And that raises questions not only about democracy, but also economic and social development in Russia in the coming years.
Well, let's take another listener's call now. Toby's with us from St. Louis, Missouri.
Hi, Neil. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Big fan of the show.
Thank you.
I fear I'm going to be redundant, though, because your earlier speaker had said that Putin likes to, you know, he's kind of for democracy, and I totally agree with who you just talked to from Moscow. He, you know, he cracked down on media that talk bad about him, and I think this is just another step closer to a dictatorship. But what's important to remember is that the Russian people are not afraid of dictatorships. You know, when they first got their freedoms, I heard a lot of slogans in our classes about who needs freedom without bread. And so they would take a dictatorship to have the wealth that Americans enjoy today.
You were in Russia at the time?
Actually, I've majored in some history courses, and I've taken a bunch of Russian history classes.
Okay, well, let's get a response from Andrew Jack.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you for the call, Toby.
Yeah, I mean, Yuri Andropov, who was, of course, one of the last Soviet leaders and previously had been the head of the KGB, I think in many ways is a role model for Putin. Andropov was coming to power within the state security services at the time Putin was beginning his career in the KGB. And as Andropov once was supposed to have remarked to one of his doctors, the priority is give the people sausages, and really the issues about democracy and freedom and so on will be one they won't worry about. And I think in the same way today, Putin, I would characterize as what you might call a liberal authoritarian. He believes that the most important priority today for Russia, if you like, is almost a sort of Chinese-style model of economic modernization of the country, the creation gradually of a middle class, strong economic growth, and therefore the restoration of Russia as something of a great power. And only then, if at all, does he really believe that democracy, at least in any Western sense, can take root.
Andrew Jack, thanks very much for being with us. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Andrew Jack is the author of Inside Putin's Russia. He joined us on the phone from Moscow. He's also a bureau chief there for the Financial Times. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Still with us is Thomas Remington, chair of the Political Science Department at Emory University and the author of Politics in Russia. And I wanted to get your take on Andrew Jack's take on what Putin is doing. Is that a reasonable conclusion, do you think?
Oh, I completely agree with him. One of the paradoxes about Putin is that he seems to believe that the market economy is the structure for the economy that's going to promote economic growth. But he does not believe in political democracy. So I hope that our listeners understand that no one seriously thinks Putin believes in democracy. He does, however, want Russia to be open economically. So Putin probably does think like the leader of an Asian country where democracy has to be put on hold for several years before people are ready for it. That's probably what he envisions for Russia. And his instincts, as I said before, are those of a policeman, a KGB leader who thinks that there has to be discipline in the state and order and even dictatorial methods where necessary in order to create economic progress for the country.
All right, let's get another caller in. Jeff joins us from Minneapolis.
Yes, hi. Well, I wanted to comment, especially the fellow that was studying in Russian history earlier. I think he hit it right on the nose. The Russian people are very much concerned about how much things cost. And I was living in Russia when Vladimir Putin was elected president, and the Russian people, I do have a great deal of hope that he will take care of one of the big issues, and because he was KGB, or KGB, was that they feel he can help ameliorate some of the corruption in the police forces, and I don't know if that's happened or not. But with regard to Chechnya, they don't like, at least where I was, I lived in northwestern Siberia, and at least the people I know didn't like Russia's interaction with Chechnya after a period of time. They were too close on the heels of Afghanistan. They remember their sons and husbands coming home in body bags, and they view the Chechen thing as getting to be that sort of issue until, and this is one of the big apartment bombing in Moscow, which was really the big terrorist event that they got pinned on Chechnya, whether it did or did not, occur because of a Chechen terrorist was never proven. But Russians, you know, then were very much in support of Putin, and these latest terrorist acts, the school and the airplanes, they're much more in support of Putin during these periods because, and it was interesting when the apartment bombing happened the next morning, and I remember this vividly. There were police officers on all the street corners, and, you know, me from an America, you don't see people with automatic weapons standing on street corners. And it was an eerie feeling to know that these things were real. You know, Russia, a country that's three times the size of the U.S., had an immediate response to that, and they were stopping anybody that looked even remotely Chechen, which you'd never get away with in this country. But the people supported that.
Well, let me ask Thomas Remington, should we, and we just have a few seconds left, I'm afraid, but do we confuse support for Putin? And we saw his, heard something about his polls very high, but do we confuse that support with support for policies in Chechnya?
You know, when your caller's absolutely right. When Putin came in the fall of 99 as prime minister, he was terribly popular because he took responsibility for very decisive military action against these bands of guerrillas. And now the question is, can Putin actually do something about the terrorist threats that emanate from Chechnya by reducing the amount of democratic support, democratic legitimacy for the system? He's taking more responsibility on himself. And it seems to me he's creating a certain vulnerability if he cannot solve the terrorist threat.
Thomas Remington, we appreciate your time today. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Thomas Remington, chair of the Political Science Department at Emory University, the author of Politics in Russia, and we thank him for his appearance today from Atlanta. When we come back from a short break, boarding up, bucking down, and, well, just plain leaving, how people in Ivan's Path are preparing for one of the strongest hurricanes on record. If you're in the path, call us, 800-989-8255. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.